Wildfires in Cape Town. Cape Town has been hit by a devastating wildfire this week. On Sunday morning, the 18th of April at 8:45 a.m., the City of Cape Town's Fire and Rescue Services responded to what was called a vegetation fire above the M3 motorway at Hospital Bend. Now, I could see this as I was on my way to our Reformation 500 celebration service here, and as I was going over the M2, I could see in distance the smoke, and I could see what looked like the lights of quite a lot of fire engines. In fact, there were 5 fire trucks, as you can see, what we call pumps in the fire brigade. There were 5 fire pumps at the call. And as the fire looked very close to the motorway, it didn't look like much of a problem. I had no doubt that they would be able to contain it very easily. This was directly opposite the famous Kruiterskuur Hospital, where Dr. Chris Barnard performed the world's first heart transplant. Well, very soon, it was being called the Rhodes Memorial Fire. At first, it was windless, and the fire looked containable. However, over the next 3 hours, the bushfire spread across the slopes of Devil's Peak to Rhodes Memorial, and there was, and some of you might have even seen the film of it, a fireball erupted behind Rhodes Memorial, and that seemed to be the gas bottles that erupted. But I've seen those gas bottles at the restaurant. They're in an enclosed courtyard, stone walls on every side, stone below it, no thatch above it. I don't see how that could have accidentally erupted, because that looked to me like sabotage, because that was an explosion. The devastation from Hospital Bend through to Rhodes Mem is quite severe. And from there, it moved on towards the Rondebosch upper campus of University of Cape Town. And the Rhodes Memorial Tea Garden restaurant went up in a fireball as gas canisters exploded. The Rhodes Memorial Tea Garden wrecked. It's a strong tea garden. You can see here people leaving literally their meals on table and just fleeing. And this beautiful restaurant where we've had many a Bible study. There were times back in the 70s and 80s and 90s when this was a Christian community. Christians ran, that's why there's a chapel. We did weddings up there, did baptisms up there. We had Bible studies on Wednesday nights at Rhodes Mem Tea Garden. One of my good friends, one of our first members of the Bible study and prayer group, I started in 6th South African Infantry, actually did the carpentry for Rhodes Mem Tea Garden. And right, one of the beams right across the doorway was "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the highest." But when the government forced them out in the mid-1990s, they took that beam out. That it was a set-in beam with the scripture on it, and all the scriptures that were in woodwork all around Rhodes Mem, and they took it out. They expelled the Christians, and I don't think this particular tea garden has been seeking the Lord for protection or blessing or anything like that lately. But the devastation of the Rhodes Tea Garden and the chapel now is pretty wild. This is where the gas bottles were kept. And again, you look and it's even got corrugated iron around. It was not thatched. This was a secure area to prevent them from exploding. It makes one wonder if this was deliberately done. The oldest windmill in the southern hemisphere was burned. Now, the historic Mostert Mill, the oldest windmill in the southern hemisphere, dating back to 1796, was burned when the fire jumped the M3 motorway. Now, that's quite a motorway to jump, considering there was no wind, really, at that time, too. Okay, it did have a thatched roof, but still, any historic thatched roof monument should have a sprinkler system in the ridge of the roof, because the only way to easily put out a thatched roof fire is to have a sprinkler system on top. And I would have thought that that's not just common sense. I would think it's law for historic monuments. So I'm not sure how that fire managed to get there. Here you can get a bit of a feel for how it has looked through the years. This historic windmill was repaired and donated to the people of Cape over 120 years ago by Cecil John Rhodes. Now it's in pretty severe ruins, although there's already plans for rebuilding it. And the sails have been damaged, but they are going to rebuild them they've got a lot of the original materials. Two thatched house dwellings in Rosebank were also severely damaged as a fire spread from Mostert's mulch adjacent homes. Again, thatched roof houses. But again, all thatched roof houses are meant to have a sprinkler system built into the ridge of the roof, just as there are at Kruger National Park and elsewhere. So I'm not sure what failed here. Then the university library and buildings go up in flames. Incredibly, six education buildings in the centre, not on the periphery, in the centre of the University of Cape Town were severely damaged by the fire. Even though these are stone buildings located in the middle of campus, and you will notice that the ivy on the outside of the buildings is not burning or affected. How did the fire leap hundreds of metres, half a kilometre or so from the fire, the bushfire, into the middle of the centre of the campus, inside the building, and burn the insides of a stone building out? Quite some distance from the Veld fire. It was darkness at midday when we came out from our Reformation 5 and celebration service on the 18th of April. The sky was turning dark, sun was turning orange. The midday sun was almost obliterated by the massive clouds of smoke. Great clouds of soot and ash were falling throughout Rondebosch, including on our mission grounds, as people rushed around to close the windows and close the doors and to keep the smoke and the ash out. And the helicopters were mobilized from Newlands Fire Station, the wildfire station, to fight the fires. It was like a war zone with great clouds of smoke, regular sounds of helicopters flying over above. Huey helicopters from the wildlife services in the wildfire services in Newlands Forest flew repeatedly overhead, each carrying buckets of 1,000 liters of water at a time. The Newlands Dam is specifically there for them to get fresh water. They can get 1,000 liters at a time. That is a ton, literal ton. By the way, if you're ever underneath when water's being dropped, you've got to lie flat on the ground. Because when that ton falls down, if you're on your feet, you will be knocked senseless and injured. The only way you can survive it is just to lie absolutely flat and try and spread the impact in that way. I've been under these things when they've dropped water on, and it's a relief if you're fighting a fire, but you want to be flat on the ground when it happens. You can't fall any further if you're lying flat. And this is quite precision work to come with these buckets of water. They're actually big canvas buckets as such, and of course they can be released at a key time, and then they open up. It's like a great claw that opens, and then the water just pours down. And these piles get quite precise that they can precision bomb. This is a kind of sight from across the bay on Sunday night. And through Sunday night, we could see some of the fire raging towards the top of Devil's Peak. Well, the firefighters struggled to contain the inferno. By late Sunday night, more than 250 firefighters were mobilized from the city of Cape Town. That would have been from the Roland Street, Main City, Cape Town, from Epping Fire Station, where I once was based, from Weinberg, from Goodwood. All the key fire stations would have been contributing all the fire pumps and workers they could. And also Table Mountain National Park, Wildfire Services working on fire, the volunteer wildfire services, all struggling to contain the inferno, which they described as out of control. Sunday night, it was definitely out of control. And then an arsonist was arrested. At 8:10 p.m. on Sunday night, a suspected arsonist was apprehended by a man and his children walking their dogs. Now, apparently, part of the neighborhood watch in that area, but of the three suspects they saw starting a new blaze above Frederhoek on the City Bowl side, the opposite side of Devil's Peak, one 35-year-old man, as they described him, was taken to custody. There's a picture of it taking place. But the two other suspects managed to evade arrest. I did hear that a second one was captured later. And that second one claimed that they had set the original fire as well. I don't know if that's true, but forensics must be done. Investigations must still proceed. In the early hours of Monday, the 19th of April, at 2 a.m., gale force winds picked up and Frederhoek residents in the line of the approaching fire were ordered to evacuate. Hundreds of residents began pouring out of their homes in the early hours of the morning with children, pets and belongings. And the disaster risk management staff and volunteers were ordering all residents to be evacuated from several streets in the suburb of the slopes of Devil's Peak, where the fire was coming right down at them. And this included the Dieter Park Towers. These are real high rises. And you don't want to be in a high rise when a fire hits, because those things can be death traps, as has been proven. In fact, in the fire brigade, we'd often say anything above 7 stories, you've put your life in your own hands, because the fire brigade cannot reach effectively above 7 stories in firefighting. So if you're in a high rise above 7 stories, well, really, you better have a really good sprinkler system and all that up there, because the fire brigade doesn't have ladders high enough, nor long enough, nor do they have hoses strong enough to reach above that. So 7th floor is about it when you think about that. And all the nearby schools, 11 schools in the area were closed due to concerns for smoke inhalation. Now, when it comes to fires, more people die of smoke inhalation than die of burns. Smoke inhalation is serious. If you're ever caught in a fire, you want to quickly, that's the one time mask might be useful, is you dampen the mask preferably and put that over to protect. But if there's smoke in a room, you get down hands and knees, you go under it, because smoke rises. Obviously, the lower down you are, the less likely you are to breathe in the smoke, or hold your breath if it's for a short time. But you don't want to breathe in smoke. That can actually ultimately kill one. 255 firefighters worked through the night, we were told, to restrain the raging wildfires. And the Frederhoek fire was finally contained by 2:30 p.m. on Monday afternoon, 12 hours later. Another house damaged in Rondebosch, again a thatched roof house. One wonders what happened to the sprinkler system on the roof. Sorry? This was also thatched. If you can see, it was thatched. Only a thatched roof can burn like that. And this is also University of Cape Town administrative office in Rondebosch. Funny, none of the houses around were affected, but somehow this was a very discriminating fire. It just leapt hundreds of meters here and 100 meters there and just got some odd targets. Very strange. 9 civilians, we're told, were hospitalized for smoke inhalation. 6 firefighters were injured in the line of duty. Approximately 600 hectares of wilderness were devastated by the wildfire. And on day 2, Tuesday, the helicopters were grounded by high winds. High winds on Monday prevented the helicopters from being mobilized in the area. And by Monday afternoon, by 3:30 p.m., the fire had wrapped around north face of Devil's Peak, was racing towards Tafelberg Road on the slopes of Table Mountain. Fire crews were now having to be mobilized to suppress this new fire threat. A lot of people spoke about this fire on Table Mountain. Well, correctly speaking, it was all on the slopes of Devil's Peak. It didn't reach Table Mountain, although you could speak about it being in the Table Mountain complex. Now, people outside of Cape Town can be forgiven for not knowing the difference, but those of us who live in Cape Town do know the difference. Well, as the winds died down, the helicopters could be mobilized again. But now, with the winds going down, what have you got? More smoke and smog and visibility down, so that's the other problem. So on day 3, Tuesday the 20th of April, the winds had slowed, leaving the city of Cape Town shrouded in smoke. Just remember, the winds are called the Cape Doctor. It blows away the smoke, the smog, the pollution, everything else, which makes it actually quite helpful. But these are these fire traps. You do not want to be in a high rise when a fire hits. There's not never enough exits. And by the way, one of the dumbest things anyone can ever do in a fire is get in a lift. Never get in an elevator when there's any kind of fire threat. Use the stairs. It's insane. You don't want to get stuck in a lift because of a short or any kind of problem. When the electricity goes, the lift is jammed. That's it. You know, you're stuck. Very bad idea. The sound of helicopter engines and whirring blades overhead continued throughout Tuesday. Really made me feel back at home on the border and so on. As the South African Air Force added more helicopters to assist the wildfire services, Hueys, and you can see that's one of our Pumas up there. I think they now call them the Oryx. To assist wildfire services, Hueys, in water bombing the blaze. And here you can see some of the old Hueys coming in for wildfire dumping. Somebody flying into Cape Town managed to get this picture on Monday night, which is quite interesting, showing there you can see Signal Hill, Lion's Head, Table Mountain, Devil's Peak, and where the fire was at that particular time. That's an interesting perspective, seeing the lights of the city. You don't often get such a eagle-eye view of what was actually going down on the ground. By the end of Tuesday, the fire department announced the fires largely contained. Largely contained is an interesting term. It can cover a multitude of sins. It means it wasn't totally contained, but largely contained. But the danger of smoldering fires re-erupting still need attention. And this is a problem. Especially in Fynbos, you can have it just smoldering. And by the way, there's many a time that there's been a fire smoldering in a room. And if the room's been shut, all doors shut, windows shut, there's not enough oxygen, the fire dies. And it can go way, way, way down. And all that's needed is somebody to open the door window and the whole thing flares up again. And you can get a massive backdraft. And you can get incinerated by opening the door of a smoldering fire. That's why firemen always feel the outside of the door before you open. you don't even want to touch the handle yet because the metal will convey the heat even more intensely than the wood. So you want to feel the door before you touch the handle, before you decide whether you're going to go in or not. And you still stand to the side when you kick it open because that's dangerous. One of the worst fires in missionary history was when in 1812, William Carey was away lecturing at Fort William College and a fire broke out in the mission warehouse at Serampore. And it was one big, massive warehouse where all the printing, translation, everything was done. And they brought the fire under control. And then a helpful Indian was walking around, opening up all the windows to clear the smoke. And the fire revived and destroyed everything. And they lost everything. All their printing presses, even the translation work of years, vast amounts of paper stock, or even the special metal castings for the press, which Dad had to make because it didn't exist. There was no castings in the alphabets of the Asian languages that he was printing. And so they lost something like 15 years worth of work. And it was, they'd stopped the fire, they'd saved everything, but it was the opening up of the windows and influx of fresh air, that fresh oxygen that reignited the fire. So in fact, re-erupting fires are a serious damage. That's why the mist right now is a godsend, and we just pray for solid rain this weekend that we can really douse all the potential fire and refresh the earth, of course. And then Jagger Library gutted by fire. The full cost of this devastating inferno is yet to be calculated. This includes the Jagger Library in the centre of the University of Cape Town. I've seen Cape Town newspapers referring to it as a 200-year-old library. I don't know how that's possible because the university's only been there 120 years. But anyway, it's obviously an old library. But the Jagger Library contained 1.2 million volumes, books and magazines and so on, including priceless, irreplaceable collections, including the majority of architect Herbert Baker's archives. Herbert Baker is one of the greatest architects in South African history. He did Union Buildings and a whole lot of other great buildings. The fire doors did come down to protect sections of the library, in which we trust was the most valuable of the irreplaceable collections, but hundreds of thousands of books were lost in the inferno. Now, questions of how the bushfire could have reached the stone buildings in the middle of campus have yet to be answered. Observe, there is Jamison Hall, and there is the Jagger Library. Notice how far away is the outskirts, and Rhodes Memorial is over there. How did the fire jump in there? None of these outer buildings are affected, but how did it get to Jagger Library? Well, my opinion as an ex-firefighter is that it wasn't the bushfire that caused that. It's got to be a separate cause. Now, showing you an aerial photograph of the damage of the fire. You can see the damage of the fire. There's Hospital Bend where it started, around the corner there. Here's Rhodes Memorial. You see that? There is Jamison Hall. There's Jamison Steps. There is the Jagger Building, Library. Do you see any fire-damaged buildings around there? Not even the trees closest to the university were touched. The fire was killed there and there because of the road being used, and so the fire brigade deployed along this line. So it never broke through the trees that shield the upper campus. It didn't get to the tennis courts or anything else like that, or the parking areas over here. In fact, most of the University of Cape Town is untouched by the fire. So how did Jagalabri get ignited? Just to give you some historic perspective, notice how forested Devil's Peak was in the past. Just look at all those trees, all the way up to the top. That's when we also had hundreds of mountain goats all over the mountain as well. This also gives you a bit of a feel for how University of Cape Town was and how forested Table Mountain was. Okay, here you can get another view, an older picture of, this is before they put up the hideous Wertmuller Center. Notice how far away from the outskirts is, there's the Jameson Hall and there's the Jagger Library. How does a bushfire bypass all these stone buildings and come inside this stone building? It's not possible. Just to give you another perspective, this is plainly University of Cape Town with the fisheye lens, but the fire, there's Rhodes Mem, the fire didn't break through those trees, it didn't affect most of these buildings, but it somehow got that building right there. Now, while we're on the point of how forested Cape Town used to be, this is Kruiterskuur Hospital, before they built that hideous monstrosity of an extension here. But just notice how forested it was on Devil's Peak, next to the M2 motorway, and forested here, and that's before they demolished all these houses in order to build extensions. This gives you another view. This is Kruiterskuur Hospital, and look at the forest immediately adjacent to the M2 motorway. And look at all the forest on Signal Hill. These are historic pictures that give us some perspective. Okay, here's another one that just shows you how forested Devil's Peak used to be. And that's the way I remember it. Heavily forested. And I don't understand how we've got a Ministry of Forestry who seems to think the job description is deforestation. Hundreds of thousands of trees have been chopped down or burned down in the Cape Peninsula since 1994, and it's completely unacceptable. You wonder why you get seasons of drought, or wildfires for that matter. So this is where the first heart transplant was performed, and then you can see how they extended, they built that massive extension over what used to be all those other houses in that area. And there still was quite a lot of forestry to the side, although that's been encroached upon now too. Environmentalists reveal that government authorities ignored repeated warnings. Nikki Schmidt of the environmental group Parkscape declared the authorities were repeatedly warned about the fire risk in Cape Town. Parkscape has claimed that the mismanagement of the Table Mountain National Park put lives and property in unwarranted danger. That's quote unquote. Parkscape, Table Mountain Watch, and Friends of Table Mountain and other environmental groups have repeatedly warned of the danger of tolerating approximately 100 vagrants living in the national park and the risks of illegal fires in the mountain slopes. If you or anyone you know attempt to start a fire for briar or whatever anywhere around Table Mountain, Devil's Peak, so on, you can be arrested, you can be put in jail. It's a serious crime to start a fire in a forestry reserve, you would think. But somehow or another, they could tolerate vagrant fires all the time there and never act, it seemed. And then they pointed out that Table Mountain National Parks, which is run by not the city but by central government, who appoint their own special party cadres to do nothing. And this area was littered with alien vegetation. And Nikki Schmidt observed the slopes where the fire started was littered with pine trunks, pine stumps, tinder dried, just waiting to go up in flames. They chopped down so much of the trees that had been there, but instead of removing them, they just left them there. Now they're getting drier and drier and drier. Of course, they cut off from the roots, and they're now dead trees, and they're just waiting for a fire. And you've got pine cones, pine needles, pine trees, stumps, trees. This is not good management. Andre van Skulpvek of Table Mountain Watch said, we have alerted sand parks to incidents on countless occasions with very little action resulting. Andy Davies of Friends of Table Mountain reported, we repeatedly complained about vagrant fires, but it appears no action was taken. Now, then you've got another interesting side drama taking place. The students have been housed in hotels, and they're demanding a holiday from study and trauma counseling. 4,000 students who evacuated from UCT upper campus, and they were getting mostly free education up there. Now they're having free accommodation arranged by the universities in hotels around the city. Incredibly, the student activists of University of Cape Town were from the first day, Sunday the 18th, demanding that all semester assignments, tests and lectures be suspended and all students be provided with trauma counselling. 4,000 students need trauma counselling. For what? Their Wi-Fi was interrupted? UCT Vice Chancellor Mumko Gethi Pakeng, in a letter to the students, confirmed no classes, no tutorials, no laboratory work or tests will take place throughout the week. I don't know why. It's not like they were exactly busy out there fighting the fires all night like the firefighters were. This shows you the entitlement mentality. Luxury buses while people wait with their roll-ons to be transported to hotels. But considering that the University of Cape Town seemed to have borne the brunt of the fire damage to buildings, it appeared amazing that they were not being mobilized to protect the library, stop the fire, help repair the damage, clean up, fix what needs to be fixed, rebuild what needs to be rebuilt. When we've had fires up in Sudan or anywhere else in the field, everyone in the community, right down to the little ones, are involved in passing buckets, getting involved, trying to beat up the fire with branches, whatever. They're all doing something. This mentality that, you know, I need a luxury bus to transport me to a luxury hotel and check my Wi-Fi while the whole university is being attacked by fire and other people are coming in to protect your things, just doesn't make sense to me. It's a sad commentary on the selfish, helpless, self-centered mentality produced by the entertainment industry and the entitlement culture that so many healthy young people did not feel a sense of duty to respond to the crisis by seeking to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. And these folks were part of the solution. They were actually doing something. But where were the thousands of students volunteering to help? They could have actually done quite a lot. Then there's the irresponsible incendiary incitements to arson. Incredibly, some irresponsible individuals made incendiary comments on social media, commenting on the Newlands fire in Cape Town. Mongameli Zwartene posted, "Every white man's house is destroyed. It's payback. This fire hit the white people at last. Leave my country," says somebody who probably arrived here a few weeks ago. These are the posts. And then, "Let it burn. Assist with petrol and paraffin to make sure." Here's Sanko Kuli tweeting, "Rhodes Memorial must burn to the ground." Well, I don't think you realize that stone doesn't burn, but anyway. "This is not just a fire, it's a cleansing process. Colonial rot has no place in society. Let it burn. Students must assist with petrol and paraffin to make sure." Well, maybe some students did assist with Jagger Library, for example. "UCT students must assist the fire by adding petrol. Rhodes Memorial must burn." Zana Cooley also retweeted the SRC Secretary General from UWC. Now, I'm assuming UWC is referring to University of the Western Cape. I don't know if there's another UWC, but "Let it burn to the ground." And shortly thereafter, he tweeted, "UCT students must assist the fire by adding petrol. Rhodes Memorial must burn to the ground, ashes to ashes." These are just some of the screenshots that some people sent me. Something else that might be significant, of course, to us, 18 April is a Reformation celebration of when Martin Luther made his stand, "Here I stand, my conscience kept the word of God." But 18 April is a Marxist revolutionary holiday in Zimbabwe. And it may be relevant that the 18th of April is marked in Zimbabwe as a public holiday, for that's when the Marxist revolution took place, they say. They call it the revolution. Dictator Robert Mugabe came to power in Zimbabwe 18 April 1980. I don't know if that's significant. Rhodes Memorial Fire, library at UCT, which Cecil Rhodes built, whether this is significant, that they chose that date, but it's something to consider. Something else to consider is, I would have thought students at university have a priority of study, but in 2015, the thousands of the students seemed to think that the most important thing they could do was to attack the statue, the monument, to the founder of the university, who had paid for the buildings, the land, and many of the actual bursaries they're studying in. And in an incredible waste of time and money and manpower and resources, they removed this monument, which I don't think improved anything. But because the vice chancellor put up with this, next thing you saw was trashing oil paintings, smashing irreplaceable original works of art, and burning these things. But when nothing was done about burning works of art on campus, they then graduated to deciding to burn more than that, and burning history of, like, Jan Smuts emblem, and then burning the jammy shuttles, which helps students to get up to campus, by the way. And so the fire brigade has had to come out before to put out fires that UCT students have started. And I don't know how many people in Cape Town are feeling that sympathetic towards UCT students, many of whom might be amongst the arsonist rioters and people who've thrown rocks at cars, like when my mother was driving along the M3 getting rocks thrown at her by the UCT students who taxpayers' money is caring for. This is an aerial view of what the aftermath of the fire is. You can still see a few smouldering bits of smoke coming up, but you can see where the devastation has come around. Here's the salt, pepper, mustard towers, pots. And you can see how close the fire came to the habitations on the edges there. Again, just reminding us how forested Devil's Peak and Table Mountain used to be. I think that should always remind us. And by the way, when they started, look how much more forested it was even before that. I mean, that's a lot of dense forestry. And again, just seeing how the extent of the fire. It got around the edges, but no buildings on the outskirts of UCT got affected by the wildfire. But miraculously, buildings in the middle got burned out from the inside. Well, the good side is the generosity of many people in Cape Town, the concern. Many Cape Townians responded valiantly by donating generous quantities of supplies, bottled water, energy bars, eye drops and so on to firefighters and other emergency service personnel. The SPCA mobilized rescues of wildlife whose habitats had been devastated. Gabriel Brown told us about a snake that he saw, a tree snake on the ground, which indicated some renewal of life. And, of course, some poor tortoises who had managed to survive. And there were porcupines who got rescued, and SPCA releasing one of the porcupines in a safer area. James 3 verse 5 says, "See how great a forest a little fire kindles." Now this is speaking about the tongue, how the tongue is a world of wrong, and how through gossip, through slander, through malicious backbiting, and through whispering, Bible has a lot to say about whispers and so on, we can actually cause a lot of damage just by what we say. And you think, there's a book I've got on my shelf called Fire in the Minds of Men. Fire in the Minds of Men is about the race riot revolutions in America in the 1960s. Fire in the Minds of Men is Marxism. They're saying that the teachings of Karl Marx puts fire in the minds of men and leads to wanton destruction of buildings and vehicles and people. And unfortunately, we've got to say that a lot of the destruction, a lot of the violence that takes place, a lot of the arson of thousands of hectares of forestry reserve around Cape Town. We had 6,000 hectares of forestry reserve in Cape Town, Cape Peninsula burned in 2015. And this is all part of the government's policy of making the Cape ungovernable. This is why we've got the largest amount, most of all the railway carriage burning out take place in the Cape. It's because the Western Cape is moving towards independence. The Western Cape is resisting what central government is doing. There is this hatred for us in the Western Cape. In fact, I've had it described to me, the ANC regard the Western Cape as unliberated territory. We still need to be liberated. No. We've still got some standards and things are still working here. So liberated means you can be like Zimbabwe, where people have to flee because there's unemployment and there's no food and you can't keep the lights on. Now, that's liberated. But, you know, when things work and people are actually happy, that's unliberated territory. And so there's fire in a negative sense, fire in the minds of men. In fact, fire in the minds of men is more dangerous than fire in a forest. Because, in fact, it's fire in the minds of men that inspired people to make social media tweets and public speeches encouraging other people to arson, which has caused how much damage? Just think how long it takes to build things up. How many millions of man hours is represented in a library like Jagger Library with 1.2 million books and volumes of journals in there. And then it takes generations to build these things up, and it takes a small amount of time for someone to burn it down. So there are the builders and there are the burners. There are the people who do things and there are the other people who criticize or attack. Now, prayer and action is needed, and praise God for those people who are showing care for those creatures whose habitats have been devastated. Please continue to pray for all those in Cape Town affected by this devastating inferno. And, you know, picture's worth a thousand words. The firemen, what they've gone through, when you're in a fire, there's no shifts, there's no going home. You're there until the job's done. And many a time, I remember coming into college smelling of smoke, and I worked midnight shifts at Epping Fire Station. I studied at Baptist Theological College during the day, and you know, people would be, you know, I didn't know you smoked, so I don't. You know, sort of got the steam coming out of you, it's an exhausting job because the dehydration. You can imagine being so close to the heat, and that kind of work. Practical projects are being planned and mobilized, including Friends of Rhodes Memorial, who are planning to clean up the monument, which was engulfed by the wildfire. The monument is in pretty good shape, we're told. Gabriel went up and did an investigation, sent me these pictures, that basically speaking, the monument is not touched because the monument's built of stone. It's got a lot of stone around it, and yes, the grass burned a lot around it, but most of the trees are unaffected, and there's been some damage. That's the bench just below Rhodes Memorial. Some of energy looked like there'd been a bit of blackening, but doesn't look like any stone is cracked, doesn't look like any of the brass is affected. The bust is unaffected. But, of course, the signs could do with revamping. Nevertheless, there's a plan now on Tuesday, 27th, to go up at 9 and do a clean-up, what they call a flash mob. Just a few happy pictures of showing the way everything was and the view, and from Rhodes Mem, and just a reminder that it is such a privilege to live in such a beautiful part of the world. The only city in the world on two oceans, on the warm Atlantic, a warm Indian Ocean, the cold Atlantic, the Cape of Storms, the Cape of Good Hope. This is a magnificent privilege to be in a city surrounded by mountains and sea and ocean with all the different wildlife, where we've got everything from dussies to squirrels to buck to whales and dolphins and sharks, seals and penguins. And this is a magnificent part of the world. And Newlands Forest. Praise God for Cecil Rhodes buying up Newlands Forest, donating it to people of Cape Town, that it wasn't just destroyed by lumber mills and used for development, and like so many other places in the world where it's just been turned into high-density housing and destroyed the forest. How many people live in a city where they're just a few minutes away from forest and mountains? Isaiah 43 verse 2 says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned, nor shall a flame scorch you." That's a promise to hold at this time. Any questions, any comments on wildfires in Cape Town? Yes.
The windmill burns just after it was renovated. It's just got renovated, and its opening day was on Saturday. It was the first opening day in a month, and then it was finished.
And there wasn't really any wind at that time. Midday on Saturday. It's just very strange how the fire could jump a double highway and get that. Very strange. And the timing.
That I've noticed with all of our fires is that for a long time now I've noticed that they, because I watch the weather in a week in advance, because I want to see if there's rain coming or surfing available. So I use Windguru, it's very good. The sailors use it, the shipping people use it sometimes. And I've noted that every time the fires, the timing is too good. It's like rain is far away, and wind is coming, and it's hot and dry. So often you have hot and dry, but then there's a cold front coming soon afterwards, and it will rain and put everything out. But I just noticed, like, we've never had it. It just seems every time we have these fires, and my opinion is if things are too coincidental, it's human. Just like
yes.
three buildings burning down that are
historic.
Our enemies want to destroy.
Yeah.
It's,
so.
It can't happen in random events. It cannot happen like that statistically.
So, Cape Town Mayoral Committee member for Safety and Security, J.P. Smith, said, all fires have human causes. The only question is whether it's accidental or whether it's malicious. But all fires have human causes, which is an interesting and worthwhile comment. But they've already arrested arsonists. Case of arson has been opened by the police. Investigation is continuing. Whether the initial fire was arson, deliberate, malicious, or accidental vagrant fire and gross neglect and mismanagement by the Ted Mountain National Parks, who've not bothered to deal with this in years, despite many reminders, that still doesn't explain the other fires, like Jagger Library, or the arsonists on Frederhoek side, which is unrelated to the initial, possibly vagrant fire that started at Hospital Bend, close to the road. So we're dealing with at least three fires that I can see here, maybe more.
I was just going to say that we wouldn't really notice the wildfires, but it wouldn't be able to spread if the conditions weren't right. So even if it was a normal wildfire, it wouldn't grow big if the conditions weren't
optimum for their purpose.
So it could just be like if it did rain that day, you wouldn't have heard anything.
Warm front preceding cold front. We never get rain, and it seems
yes.
to be timed too well.
Any other observation?
Popping up at 2-3 in the morning, like it was pumping southeast at 2.
Yes. Any other observations? I mean, we all saw different aspects, experienced different parts. Any other observations, Daniela?
The student's white building, also the roof had caught a bit of fire, and then there was a bit of water damage. They caught it in good time, but yeah, some of the roof quite a bit damaged. I think they caught a bit of fire.
Now that's lower campus.
It's middle campus.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was by Stanley Road and the message the church I go to meets there, and they met there that morning. But the church ends around 11, and it's going to be later that happened.
Now, I know I've been there before, and it certainly doesn't have a thatched roof.
But another thing, apparently, the Smuts Hall, the residents that also caught some fire, and there was a group of students that actively put that out.
Good, that's what you'd expect.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Any other observations, insights?
Well, the politicians surely didn't waste that. This morning and yesterday morning there was riots and demonstrations in front of the High Court. They really rallied everyone up for this again. To such an extent that you needed a bit of an escort to go into court.
For what purpose? What were they demonstrating with?
Housing, free housing, all of these. Each group had their own thing. It was so chaotic you couldn't really get the hang of it. So I think it's very important that we be constructive in what we do, especially like Daniela said, for the students that actually went to put out the fire and stuff like that. Because I also saw the other side when the students went to the hotels and there they were going partying past midnight, having a great time, flooding the pool area and just enjoying themselves.
Yeah, those individuals probably don't belong in university. So it's I don't know what the stats are now, but some years ago I saw the statistic that something in a region of 84% of tertiary students in South Africa who start first year don't graduate. 84%. Now, the vast majority, and I remember the stats, that the vast majority of first years don't finish first year. And the vast majority, even more, of those who start at any tertiary program don't finish it. So there's a vast amount of people who shouldn't be at university, plainly. And the reason why they accept it is because the universities are incentivized to get more students. The more students they have, even if they're not suitable, even if it's not going to help them, even if it's not necessary for their career or anything like this, they get more money from the government if they've got more students. And so these universities are just going for numbers, numbers, numbers. Whereas, remember when I was applying to Baptist Seminary, they really want to know that you've got a full-time calling to ministry and there's so much checking and cross-examining because they didn't want to just take the numbers. Now, later it changed. It was just like anyone can come. It doesn't matter what your reasoning or purpose is. But at that stage, we were very concerned to limit the people coming in. There was a time that, for example, to get into Oxford or Cambridge, you had to be able to debate in Latin to be accepted as a student. And so there was all kinds of serious entrance qualifications to restrict. And so universities were not a massive mob. It was a selected group of real academics who are called for that kind of work. But in recent years, it's turned to a business. And now it's mostly about money and mostly about numbers. The more the merrier. And the fact that most of the people are going to waste their time, waste their parents' money, waste the taxpayers' money, doesn't bother the university leadership because it's all about numbers, bigger grants, more money. And so when you've got students who in a time of crisis want to go out partying, they obviously don't belong in university at all.
Well, there were such a bunch of elite students that the hotel guests were complaining that much that they had to shift the students from the hotel guests even during meals because the two groups couldn't mingle properly, so they had to separate it, despite the whole complaints.
Whatever happened to housing people in a scout hall and things like that? You know, how come they've got to go into hotels? Army tents would do just fine. Worked for me for years. Rat packs are good, actually. Let me tell you, you get some. It's a really fun meal in the average rat packs. No, we were donated a whole lot of ration packs for our mission, and we'd never eaten so well as when we had these ration packs up in the field. And I thought, wow, you know, why did we complain about these normies? These are really good. But yes, give them ration packs and put them in tents. But that's the problem. A sense of entitlement doesn't actually help the person. If you hate someone, give them lots of things for free and don't expect anything of them. Because that's going to ruin their character. But when you actually draw people out and you put them to work and you give them a sense of purpose and you stretch the capabilities, then that's loving because that's helping the person become a better person. But just university, that's all academics and no character building. That's not really helping the people. It's just producing more wicked people.
Yeah, there is a mother said we should try and get them to understand that what they're burning down is their very own university. It's no longer a white university or Rhodes is already gone. It's not benefiting off it at all. It's the students that's benefiting off it. And if it's burned down, who's going to rebuild it? Who's going to replace it? It's not going to be magically newer or better or anything like that. There's going to be something to replace it, or you have to replace it. And who's going to do that if it's burned down? Just to get them thinking about what's the consequences of the actions of destroying what's there.
Good advice, good observation. Any other reactions?
What about just these things like the Herbert Baker Collection and that? I mean, can we...
UCT has not given us the slightest hint of what was saved and what wasn't. Now, we know that they had some collections behind these fire doors that came down, which did their job. But everything that was out in the main reading hall and so on, which you could see there's several levels and there's a lot of bookshelves all the way along, those were all incinerated. So I would hope that the most valuable collections were being protected, but we've heard that amongst the things that were lost was the full collection of every book ever published in or about Africa, 70,000 books. And then they had that collection was destroyed, the African printed collection, and then there's another collection that was there were 3,500 DVDs, which is apparently every film ever produced in South Africa or something. That was not protected. That went up in flames too. So there's... They obviously didn't have every collection behind the fire doors. Again, I'm wondering what happened, because in most libraries I know, if you go to Wittenberg Luther House, they've got all these signs around for hell on gas, so that the moment there's any smoke detect alarm goes off, the hell on gas pushes all the oxygen out. Of course, you must get out too, because we need oxygen just like a fire does. And then all the doors come down, they're sealed. And so a lot of libraries and certainly art galleries have got this kind of protection. And then they've got, of course, some sections they'll have sprinklers, but sprinklers will do damage to books. So others they'll just have gas. But there's meant to be an automatic anti-fire response in extremely valuable libraries. Considering UCT's got a budget in the billions, you would imagine surely their library should have had some of the best protections on the planet, because it's one of the biggest libraries in the country. Is there an older or bigger library in South Africa? I'm not sure that there is, with the possible exception of the one just behind Parliament. We've got the South African Library, and that, I don't know if it's as big, but I know that's got all the protections. So what happened? Where's the protection? And in, I don't know. I've got one of the pictures that I didn't show here, but a picture came through to me of Mostert Mill. And funnily enough, as you can see, everything gutted and burned. There's the fire extinguisher still on the wall. And evidently it wasn't used. But where's the human beings who are meant to be protecting? What happened to the automatic responses? What happened to fire alarms? I would say that this was inside job arson, personally.
We have to ask whether this place is a safe repository for valuable collections going forward.
Maybe it was, but it's now in the hands of people who are not reliable. Correct, yes.
In the week I read a news in the whole part of the world, and they wrote that as we went to our first of our African literature studies, or what they call alternative histories were destroyed.
Yes.
Because, it was most somewhat what was
destroyed was modern revisionist. Some of it Marxist, yeah. Yes, in fact, they mentioned that quite a lot of things they lost were the kind of things that you would have thought they would have wanted to keep. For example, it had a whole, they had the full collection of every Cape Argus and Cape Times printed since the 1850s, 1860s, which would have included Karl Marx articles, because, you know, Karl Marx wrote a regular weekly article for Cape Town newspaper. And, you know, one of Karl Marx's daughters buried in Cape Town. She married Jutta. Jutta is the one who publishes all the university textbooks and so on. And so we've got interesting connections. South Africa's got the second oldest communist party in the world, by the way. Karl Marx was well linked to South Africa, because so many of his followers came here for the diamond and gold mine rushes. Of course, workers of the world unite. You've nothing to lose but your gold. And so I think they lost a lot of things in the library that were their own, which is, you know, an own goal. But we think everything's valuable, even information about our enemies, because we value knowledge. We're not into destroying knowledge, but the people who start these things, do they think through the consequence of what they do? It's blind hatred. Fire in the minds of men leads to arson.